Good morning, everyone. Happy Easter. Great to see all of you. If I've not met you before, my name is Chad, and I'm the pastor here at Kings Park Community Church. Welcome to you also if you're joining us online. A number of years ago, I had an opportunity to have a series of meetings with a guy who was a professed atheist, but a really friendly guy, and he had met a couple of Christians and one of them within our church, and he just said, I have no animosity towards people of belief, but I just grew up with a worldview. There was no God. That's always been my basic assumption. But I've met some really nice people. You seem to be normal, intelligent people. And I would like to find out why it is that you believe. So because I was a pastor in the church, we agreed to have a series of meetings. We read through one of the Gospels together. And then towards the end of that, after he had heard everything, he said, well, look, thank you for taking that opportunity. I may now see myself as an agnostic. I'm not really sure what I think about all of this, but I certainly appreciate your beliefs and your values. He said, but can I just make one suggestion to you as a pastor and as a Christian and to all of you Christians? He said, I always hear from you, Jesus died on the cross for my sins. Jesus died for my sins. He said, but having just read through the Gospels, it seems like the punchline to the Gospels is that Jesus rose again. And he said, I think that's a much more positive message. Maybe what you should do is kind of remarket yourself, and instead of saying, Jesus died for my sins, say, Jesus rose again to give me new life. And I said, look, I think you're getting the point. I did point out to him, I said, Jesus could not rise again from the grave unless he had died and been buried there first. And these two things are not in opposition. They're the different sides of the exact same coin. But I took on board what he was saying. While the cross, quite rightly, has become a central symbol of Christianity, the conclusion of the Gospels is not that Jesus died and, oh yeah, by the way, then later on he rose again. The conclusion, the powerful conclusion to the Gospel is that Jesus is alive. And just to quote again, we'll go to the screen, something that Glynis has already shared with us, but just part of that sentence, Paul, reflecting back on these things, makes this statement, if there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. More than that, we are found to be false witnesses about God because we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. Over the Easter season, I spent some time listening to a podcast where they interviewed two different people, one of them an ancient historian, one of them an ancient archaeologist, and they were particularly talking about crucifixion. It was quite a gruesome sort of podcast. But one of the points that they were bringing out is that the point of crucifixion wasn't just to kill someone or to humiliate someone. It was to utterly dehumanize them and then obliterate their memory from the earth. Most people who were crucified were not even given a burial. They were thrown on the scrap heap and they were eaten by the animals. The idea was to erase their name, to shame them so bad and erase their name from all of human history. And the interesting thing is it's only been in the last century that they've actually found archaeological evidence in graveyards of crucified people. Because for the most part, while ancient records in the Bible and outside of the Bible record that there were tens of thousands of people who were crucified, we don't find them because their names were erased from history. And the point that these historians were bringing out is if Jesus Christ had not been raised from the dead, we would know nothing about him. We wouldn't be talking about him today. We wouldn't be here in this room today. It is the resurrection of Jesus Christ that has put him on the map and at the center of human history and into our lives. Jesus Christ has died for our sins, but indeed, he has been raised from the grave. And that's why today I want to just briefly look at four sets of witnesses, individual or collective witnesses, that John includes. And one of the things you'll have picked out through the Bible reading and through the video is that at the death of Jesus, the lives of these people hadn't been changed. Jesus had told them what was going to happen and everything about it, but it was at the resurrection that their lives were transformed and utterly changed, and so along with human history. And so the first of these witnesses is Mary Magdalene. Now, I always like to point out about Mary Magdalene, it's been very interesting, but basically in the last 50 years or so, there's been a couple of Hollywood movies and then a couple of airport novels that out of nowhere, based on no history in or outside of the Bible, there are no records in human history that record this, but suddenly they decided to make Mary Magdalene Jesus' love interest. The bizarre thing about this, just by the way, is part of it is that kind of intimate scene where this woman comes in who lived a sinful life and she wets Jesus' feet with her tears and she wipes his feet with her hair and all of that, which we're told in the scriptures was actually a way to prepare him for burial. But the problem is that was Mary, the sister of Martha. It wasn't Mary Magdalene. So this whole little thing is basically based on some people who know nothing about the scriptures and they just randomly picked, you know, someone has to be the love interest in every movie, and so they decided Mary Magdalene was Jesus' love interest. But there is nothing to suggest that. One of the most interesting things to me about Mary Magdalene is that in the scriptures, she's a nobody. And until you get to the point of Jesus' death and resurrection, she hasn't even come on the scene. In fact, there's only one place where she is mentioned prior to Christ's death and resurrection, and that's back at Luke 8. This is the only historical information we have about Mary, and she's mentioned along with a number of other women as well. So I'm reading from Luke 8, verses 2 and 3. The 12 disciples were with him, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had come out. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, the manager of Herod's household. Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own means. And so based on that information, what we know about Mary Magdalene, the only background information we know of her is that she was formerly demon-possessed. She would have been seen as a madwoman. Jesus had healed her. She was eternally grateful, and to the very end, she followed Jesus, and along with a number of other women who had also been helped and healed by Jesus, they actually help support the ministry of Jesus and of the disciples. That's all the background information we have about Mary Magdalene. And it's also very interesting because if you were going to make up a gospel, you wouldn't use, especially in the first century, an ex-demon-possessed madwoman to be the first person to see Jesus. She's not a good witness. She's no one. She's a woman in the first century, and she's ex-demon possessed. She's raving mad. It's not the person that you use to record. You know, the gospel writers are writing this down. They're going, oh, it may have been true, but could we put somebody else there first? This seems to be one of those classic cases of how Jesus would take a child and bring the child into the midst and say, you know, you need to become like this child. The first will be last, but the last will be first. I've come here to lower down the proud, but to raise up the humble. And that is what we see in the case of Mary Magdalene. What John points out when we finally get to the point of Christ's crucifixion is that Mary Magdalene is one of the few people who's mentioned there. She watched the crucifixion happen. We know that she was standing there and she was watching where Jesus was buried. She was going to follow him to the end. We know that she was among the first, it seems like with another group of women, to go to a tomb to anoint Jesus' body on that day that we are celebrating today. And John
points out to us that she was the first to see the risen Jesus. And here is the really extraordinary thing to me about Mary Magdalene. What does Jesus say? Go and tell my disciples. These 12 disciples are going to be called the apostles. Do you know what apostles means? The sent ones. The eyewitnesses who were sent out to go and proclaim the gospel, to be the first witnesses. Jesus says to this no-name, nobody, ex-demon-possessed mad woman, I'm sending you to the sent ones. You are my apostle to the apostles. Go and tell them that I have risen from the grave. Mary had obviously been impacted by Jesus' life and death. She followed him to the end. But it was the resurrection of Jesus that changed and transformed Mary's life. And what's interesting in John's gospel is that interwoven with the story of Mary is the story of Peter and John. And it, you know, you get a little information about Mary, and then you get some information about Peter and John, and then it goes back to Mary again. And what seems to be happening here is we're going from, you know, if you were going to build a hierarchy of disciples and Jesus' followers, you got Mary at the very bottom. But Peter and John, in regard to the disciples, they are at the top of the pole. Peter and John, as you read through the Gospels, they are mentioned often. They are amongst the first to be called as Jesus' disciples. In fact, there were three disciples, Peter and then the brothers James and John, that were in Jesus' inner circle. It was these three people who were taken up to the Mount of Transfiguration at certain points when there were healings that needed to be done. Sometimes Jesus only allowed these three to be entrusted to certain key moments of his life, Peter, James, and John. Now, James, John's brother, gets killed very early in the piece. If you read through Acts, you realize that he disappears quite quickly. And Peter and John are the two main disciples. As the scriptures point out sometimes, they are the early pillars of the church. It is of Peter that Jesus says, I'm naming you. His name was Simon, but I'm going to give you the name Peter, Petros, the rock. You know, and on this, around this rock, I will build my church. John, in his gospel, is described as the disciple whom Jesus loved. And as you go through the book of Acts, you see that Peter and John are very prominent. Mary is a no one. Peter and John, very prominent. But one of the other things is, if you do read the scriptures, you point out that even though the gospels are probably based primarily on Peter and John's testimony, Peter in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John in the gospel bearing his name, they have no problem saying that they were very frail and flawed and broken people. And we could give you lots of examples of that. But in the case of Peter, keep in mind that he was the brash person, always the first one out of the gate, but quick to stumble. And he was the one who said, even if everyone else falls away, Jesus, I will be there to the very end. And Jesus says to John, you will deny me three times before the rooster crows. And sure enough, that is what happens with Peter. And John is not, you know, perfect by any stretch of the imagination either. Remember that it was actually James and John who went with their mother to go to Jesus and said, hey, can we get to be the ones that sit at your right and left hand in your kingdom? They hadn't quite got it yet. And Jesus was trying to say, you know, can you walk the path that I walk? Can you carry the burden? Oh, absolutely we can. You know, they're all ready to go. But one of my most outstanding stories about John and his failure is that when James and John were walking through Samaria, the hated enemies of the Jews, and the Samaritans reject Jesus. And so they said, Jesus, may we call fire down from heaven and torch this village. Now, he's not just using metaphors there. He was picking up on Old Testament imagery where this had happened. John, the beloved disciple, John, who is, you know, whenever you read his gospels and his letters, are full of love for one another. looked at this village of Samaritans and said, can we torch the people? Can we burn it to the ground? And Jesus refused them. This is Peter and John. And so once again, it's the resurrection that's going to transform their lives. But what I find really interesting is, having been just told about Mary, we now know that Mary goes back and tells the disciples. And of course, who is it? It's Peter and John. Again, the first ones out of the gate. They go running to the tomb. John probably being a little bit more religious and, you know, worried about, you know, going into graves and things like that and being unclean, stands outside. Peter, being the guy he is, tears and goes straight in, throwing caution to the wind. And it's a curious thing because the scriptures tell us that they look and they believe. But what did they believe? They believed Mary's testimony that he's not there. But the scriptures also record, and I'm reading from John 20, verses 9 and 10, they still did not understand from the scriptures that Jesus had to be raised from the dead, and then the disciples went back to where they were staying. They saw, but they still didn't believe. How many times did Jesus say to his 12 disciples, and especially to Peter and John, I'm going up to Jerusalem. I'm going to be handed over to the Gentiles. I'm going to be crucified, and on the third day, I'm going to be raised again. Now Mary comes and says, he's not there, he's risen. And they go and they look and they go, what in the world is going on here? It's Peter and John, the two great apostles, the authors of our Gospels. And until a little bit later on in the story, they actually physically witness Christ's resurrection. It is then that their lives were changed. Mary's life was transformed by the resurrection. Peter and John's lives were transformed by the resurrection. Then I want to go to this figure that we often call Doubting Thomas. Now, Doubting Thomas gets a very bad rap. And one of the things that I want to point out about Thomas is that if you read the scriptures carefully, he really just represents the doubts of all of the other disciples. Because he is the last one to have an eyewitness encounter. Through his encounter, we get to see the doubt of Peter and John and James and everyone else, you know, all the way down the line. But one of the things that we do find out about Thomas through the scriptures is that he is, you can call him the cynic, you can call him the skeptic. Let's just be nice and we'll call him the realist. But he is the one who wants to call things exactly the way that he's seeing them. So when we earlier looked at the account of Lazarus in John chapter 11, when Jesus was going to go back down to Jerusalem and the disciples knew that his life was in danger there, Thomas, who's known as Didymus, said to the other disciples, well, let's go so that we can die with him. That was his take on it. Well, we're following this guy. He's going back to Jerusalem. We've warned him. He won't listen to us. Let's go die with him. It's just cynicism. In John chapter 14, when Jesus was saying he'd come to show them the way to the Father and saying, you know the way. In John 14:5, Thomas said, Lord, we don't know where you're going. So how can we know the way? Isn't it wonderful, those guys who will say the thing that everyone else is thinking? They'll ask the stupid question on your behalf. That's Thomas. And then in John 20:25, Thomas says, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were, put my hand in his side, I will not believe. But again, as I said, if you read through the Gospels carefully, you'll realize that's something that every last one of them said at some point in time. I'm going to read to you from Luke 24, verses 9 to 11. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11. This is the women. Told these things to the disciples. And it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and the others with them, who told this to the apostles But they, that is the 11 disciples, did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. As you saw in the video, you've been driven mad. As the women came and told about the resurrection, they said, "You're crazy." But then when we get down to today's Bible reading, John 20, verses 19 and 20, we're told, after Jesus had said this, he showed them. He showed the other disciples, Thomas wasn't there, he showed them his hands. He showed them his hands and his side, and then the disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. In other words, the other disciples didn't get it either. Until they actually saw Jesus face to face, none of the disciples believed. None of them were impacted until they saw the risen Christ. And then that sets up the story of Thomas, because now there's only one remaining disciple who has not had this experience. And that sets up a great moment, because while we see in Thomas doubt and his skepticism, the unbelief of all of the other disciples, Thomas actually goes above and beyond what anyone else has said. Mary calls him teacher, and the other disciples say, "We believe." But when Thomas, the realist and the cynic, finally sees Jesus face to face, he kneels down, he worships Jesus, he declares, "My Lord and my God." John uses Thomas to bring his opening statement to a bookend, because John begins his gospel saying of Jesus, "In the beginning was the Word, Jesus, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And now we've had Christ's death and resurrection, and Thomas, the last of the disciples, kneels down and worships and says, "My Lord and my God." Thomas' life and the life of the other disciples and the life of his female followers were transformed because of Christ's resurrection. But the final set of witnesses can go almost unnoticed, but I want us to notice this today. Because having spoken to Thomas, now Jesus wants to speak about those who have seen, those who have not seen and yet have believed. So reading from John 20, 29, "Then Jesus told Thomas, 'Because you have seen me, you have believed, but blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed.'" Jesus offers a special blessing on the many disciples who will come afterwards, the thousands who will believe on the day of Pentecost, the thousands more who will come to believe as the gospel goes on throughout the world, and then the hundreds of millions around the world and throughout 2,000 years of human history who, unlike Mary and the other women, who, unlike the disciples, will believe in Jesus, having never seen him and his resurrection. And that is because Jesus prayed for these people. Back in John chapter 17, when Jesus is explaining everything that is about to happen, then Jesus prays for his disciples, for the 12, and then he says, "My prayer is not for them alone. I pray for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me." If you're sitting in this room today and celebrating Easter as one of Christ's followers, I just want you to know that Jesus prayed for you on that day. Because he is your Lord and your God, and because he is the good shepherd, and he knows each one of his sheep by name, knows the number of hairs on your head, and knows every other detail about your life. On that day, Jesus prayed for you. He had you in his mind. He prayed that you would believe. He knew you would be here. He knew that one day he was going to make sure that you heard the gospel through the apostles and through the word of theirs that was written down. But he also knew that he would send out his Holy Spirit, the same Spirit that his Father had sent out on him. Having risen from the grave and gone to the Father's side, he would pour out his Spirit on you. And he would open your blind eyes so that you could see. He would open your deaf ears so that you could hear. He would open your dull mind so that you could understand. And he would take a dead, cold stone heart and cause it to live again. And while you would never have seen Jesus face to face, as Mary needed to do, as Peter and John needed to do, and as all the other disciples needed to do, you would know he was alive. Why? Because of some history books and some things that you had heard? No, you would come to know that he is alive because he is alive in you. As the old song says, you ask me now how I know he lives. He lives within my heart. His followers got to see him face to face. For you, he did one better. He moved and lived inside of your heart. He's taken up residence inside of you. And for that reason, you believe. Which brings us to John's conclusion of this part of the story. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. If you're here today as one of Jesus' disciples, you can celebrate the fact that Jesus has come to you and wanted you to know him. And if you're here and you're not sure what you believe, I just pray that you'll help that these through this testimony that you will hear the voice of Jesus saying, I love the world so much that I came to die for your sins and rise again so that you will have new life. And this is the great message of Easter, and it's what we're going to celebrate as we sing our final song together.